Thanks for listening to ASAP Frontline. Be sure to access the link in the episode description and get CME credit for listening to this episode. Or you can log in at www.asep.org/ECME. That's www.asep.org/ECME.
Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline. two of my favorite folks from the Chattanooga side of things, and apparently we're going to hijack one of them again back to Kentucky. So I think that ultrasound is probably what's been something that's been a growing role in emergency medicine, but also something that there's still a great deal of potential, because even we were talking the fact that I want to learn more on lungs and on nerve blocks and things like that, and I'm still doing a lot of studies, probably, you know, five or six a shift on the overnight shift. So, gentlemen, bring it. What you got?
So my name is Ben Smith. My ancestors founded Cleveland, Tennessee. And I have an ancestor that's name was Thorkill. It's all true.
My name is Jacob Avila.
You don't know anything about me.
I've got recent gains.
Okay, that's true.
Gains.
I have I've been squatting a lot more than I normally do.
Yeah. And I recently decided to reject Chattanooga and move back to Lexington.
Ben and I are getting a divorce.
Yes. Oh, yeah, an ultrasound divorce.
So we're getting ultrasound divorce.
Husband divorce. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah.
All right. In case you didn't figure that out, they decided to Ben and Jacob decided to swap there for a moment, just for the sake of, I guess, stabbing each other on the way out. So you guys talked today here at Tennessee ASAP about the ultrasound and use of placement of peripheral IVs, and I'm a really big proponent of this. I do it, honestly, most of my ultrasounds now in the emergency department are related to access issues. And the combination of what you guys talked about today and a post that hit Twitter last night about the flow rates associated with an 18-gauge peripheral versus your triple lumen catheters and things like that, I think it's an incredible topic to talk about. So get us into it about the role of ultrasound in terms of access in the emergency department.
So I actually started doing this. Ben was my attending when I was in residency, and he got me into doing these. And I've seen just a vast improvement, I think, in just patient outcomes. I mean, we're placing a lot less central lines than we used to, which you might think is bad, but I think ultrasounds are actually takes a little more skill to place ultrasound-guided IVs. And the patients seem to like it a lot better. They typically hurt a lot less. They're not sticking in the neck. And I honestly, when a patient comes in sick, I'd much rather have two of my ultrasound-guided 18-gauge IV catheters above the AC than a central line, because I can just push drugs a lot faster that way. I don't know if you ever been in this situation, but when I started residency, before I learned how to do these, I mean, sometimes we would place central lines to put fluids and then take it out and discharge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sickle cell, especially. Sickle cell patients was, and now with all of the chronic diabetics, chronic kidney disease, drug abuse, all that stuff, access is hard, and not to mention the general habitus of our patient population tends to put a little bit more cushion between our peripheral, between the surface and the peripheral IVs. And that's the issue I have with it is the fact that it's not a primary skill. So it's almost like when we argued back 15 years ago now, with that initial ultrasound transition of central lines, of saying, well, most of the folks I worked with said, well, we're just going to do it blind. You know, we're going to do the typical landmark technique, and if we can't get it, then we'll use ultrasound. Now, sure, those were beast ultrasounds back in those days, but it's the same way now. We're going to stab you 10 times to where you really hate us, and then we'll bring in the thing that's going to get it on the first try.
Right, with minimal pain because you're not digging around.
Right, and you're watching it go in.
It's interesting, actually, that the concept that physicians do central lines. You know, we're kind of we're big on, you know, coming in, being the big physician, going in to put the central line in when no one else can get access. But in fact, it's harder to get a peripheral line. I almost feel like we should be doing the peripheral lines and maybe the nurses be doing the central lines.
Just because there's a bigger target.
Yeah, it's a bigger target. It's just easier procedure, much easier procedure than these peripheral lines. But it'll, you know, markedly decrease the number of central lines that you're putting in. I actually had a physician come up to me at this meeting just a few minutes ago who said that since he started doing these about 5 years ago, that his numbers of central lines went down so dramatically that he actually lost credentials at his hospital for central lines, so he had to get through and interestingly get re-credentialed. But that's actually best for patient care.
Yeah, that's a good patient-centered outcome.
Absolutely,
right there, I think.
Yeah. I was proud of that guy. I mean, if you can lose your central line credentials because you do so many peripheral lines, it's better for the patients.
Well, absolutely. I went from probably two or three central lines a week to maybe one or two a year now.
Yeah.
And it's that same thing as there's no need for it. I mean, not only because I can get peripheral access, it's easier, less invasive, less complications, flow rates are superior. Mm-hmm. And the fact that at our hospital, more often than not, if you put in a line in the emergency department, it's considered dirty. And so they're replacing it when they get to the floor, so the patient gets the cost and potential complications of two invasive procedures. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that we need to bring in. And one thing we're trying to drive at our particular hospital right now is the nurses' competency on on IVs, peripheral IVs with ultrasound. And interestingly, the hospital is pushing it almost, the competency is as complicated if they are putting in the deep line. I mean, I went through less for the deep line certification. But now with the hospital having to do all these things, practiced, observed, signed off, all that stuff, whereas it almost seems like it should be just the opposite, where you need to actually have the check-off competencies for the peripheral landmark as opposed to the ultrasound, which is almost cheating.
Yeah, yeah. I am not good at placing regular IVs.
No,
I'm placing like maybe, I don't know, 200 or 300 ultrasound guided IVs now, like a lot, like since I started in residency. And every time I try to place a landmark, even if it looks easy, those I think are way more difficult and way more potential to harm than your ultrasound. I mean, it's like you said, you're cheating.
Mm-hmm. And I'm probably placing about two or three a shift right now of the peripheral, ultrasound guided peripheral. And it's not even just for my patients. It's my patients. It's other patients that are in the ER before they go to the floor. You know, they come in and say, we just haven't been able to get access. And so make myself available to the other physicians. And the nice thing is that it is a billable procedure, especially if you do phlebotomy.
Sure.
So making sure that you document it, not just do it, but document it. Mm-hmm. It's not going to, you're not going to be living on a yacht somewhere because of it. But, at least something that rewards you for getting in there and taking the time to actually help people out and make them feel better.
Right. Agreed.
So how is the key of getting this implemented to your physicians and to the nursing? So, you're listening out there and you've thought, well, I do some DVT ultrasounds and maybe occasionally I do this. How do I bring this in and say, get a good program put together to get everybody up to speed with peripheral IVs?
I was going to start with education. Obviously, most shops now do have ultrasound immediately accessible, point of care ultrasound for the physicians. And being able to get a small course together with some, peripheral phantoms is a good place to start just to get the technique down. And then honestly, the peripheral IVs, I mean, the complications are so minimal that once you have a good training course, you can start kind of doing these, like superficial peripheral IVs using regular length catheters and then sort of advance to using the longer catheters. I think that's a 100% appropriate approach to doing these. And it is 100% practice. Just like any of these ultrasound guided procedures, you have to practice.
What about the complication rates? I mean, I don't know if you know the numbers right off the top of your head of the traditional number of sticks versus ultrasound guided IV sticks. And I think the numbers that are really telling are those on pediatrics.
So as far as the adult literature goes, the numbers are about the same. As long as you're using the appropriate technique, which is using a sterile tegaderm, you don't have to use the full sheath, but just a tegaderm on the ultrasound transducer, you use some sterile jelly, and you clean the area of the skin. Basically, anything that's near the puncture site is clean. Your complication rate for ultrasound is exactly the same as your complication rate with a landmark, as far as like infection risk and all that stuff. Although you do have significantly less arterial punctures and nerve punctures with the ultrasound, but the infection rate is not any worse by using the ultrasound. It's not a huge. I mean, there's not really a downside to using it.
What about the number of needed to stick? Number of times it's gonna. How many attempts is it gonna take me? Traditional blind landmark technique versus the ultrasound to get access?
Well, you probably would be much less tries with the ultrasound, but someone who's starting out, obviously, I mean, they're not going to do as well with the ultrasound. There are a few studies. There's one that was done in nurses. They showed that the rate of you know, kind of completion, getting these consistently, kind of hit an exponential curve upwards after about 10 or so, between 8 and 10. So after nurses had 8 to 10 ultrasound-guided IVs under their belt, their accuracy went up to 85-90% in all comers. So it takes, you got to put a couple under your belt. And initially, you are going to not be as good as your landmarks. Mm-hmm. But once you do a few, you get better. And you do better down the road. So, it's just practice. Beginners will do worse, but that's any procedure. Once you get a little more advanced, and advanced is 8 to 10 tries, you do well.
So not like a whole bunch, not like a 200, 300 case series.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Was the pediatric study coming out from anesthesia with the sticks, basically 1.2 sticks with ultrasound versus about double that, 2.5 to 3 sticks for the traditional landmark technique in pediatrics? That's among, you know, anesthesia providers that do access all the time.
Right.
And so I think it's definitely something you guys got to get in there. And they're cheap. I mean, it's the ultra, well, cheaper. When I first started off, 5, 6 years ago, the first bedside or point of care ultrasound that we purchased, we're talking $120,000, $140,000.
Wow.
And the most recent one we bought a little over a year ago is probably head and heels, but, you know, above that, and was $45,000 with all the bells and whistles that we need in emergency medicine, the 3 probes. I told them if they brought the transvag probe in the hospital, I was going to drive over it.
We're not. You meant the endocavitary probe.
Yeah.
We have many uses for that probe.
Well, I know it has increased. It has increased exponentially. I mean, I don't think my sleep will ever recover again after seeing Matt Dawson check out his own tonsils with a probe. I mean, one, I don't know how he didn't gag and vomit.
Gag reflex.
He was born that with no gag reflex.
Okay.
And then, you know, two, it's just, I'm still growing up thinking it's the transvaginal probe, and I don't care how well you clean it.
I will say, as far as back to peripheral IVs, that you definitely need to invest in some of those long IV catheters. And so
that's key.
So at our shop, they're only like, it sort of depends the brand that you buy. They're sort of like $4 a piece up to, if you want to spend up to like the Cadillac versions, like $15 a piece. Depending on what company you go with, but these are, you know, at least 2.5 inch long catheters so you can get down to the deep veins in the upper arm, and that's kind of a critical part of this procedure, because if you try to take a regular angiocath and try to put it in a basilic vein, you're going to end up it's going to get displaced. You're not going to get to the vessel unless they're super skinny, you really have to get your emergency department to stock those.
Well, you guys are even going with the longer ones, because we're using the 1.88 inch to the 2 inch, you know, basically once you get to the 16s. And I think I would safely say, on average, the average ultrasound-guided IV that I place, the vein is probably about a centimeter down. And so you got a centimeter down, centimeter back. If you want to use a little A squared, B squared equals C squared, how long you're going to need to get there, that's still a pretty decent catheter. And what I do like about it, though, is when you get those veins, the catheter is long enough that it's got a good thread, so you're not going to have that little bit of movement that pulls the catheter out, displaces it. You know, a lot of times the vein is blown because the catheter is only in by 5 millimeters.
Yep.
And so it easily slips out anytime the patient moves or they rehydrate, the tissue rebounds. Mm-hmm. Whereas these, you're going to have an inch or so inside the tissue, which is going to make, you know, a giant difference.
Right.
So what other changes? What else is exciting in the world of ultrasound? What's new, and what are we? What are the big advances that are going to change my practice?
Well, everything's exciting about ultrasound, Ryan.
Oh well,
it's all exciting.
Okay. So I brought. Okay.
You want to know what we're most excited about?
Okay. Yes, I want to know what's most exciting. Okay, let's say most exciting for the person who's not a sound wave nerd.
So if I was stuck on Desert Island and had to like pick one examination to do, it's the echo. That's the one that I think will change the management the most. And learning how to do a good echo, identify the 3 main things, you know, the right heart strain, the pericardial effusion, tamponade, and the ejection fraction. If you learn one thing about ultrasound, that's the one that will change management. That's the one that will save a life. I mean, how many times do we have patients that come in with, like, you know, like sepsis and they're just in florid heart failure?
Yep. Or transferred with an NSTEMI and they got a huge PE.
Right.
Yeah, these patients, and really any undifferentiated hypotension, you know, patient needs to have a bedside echo. And it is the best. I agree with you, Jacob. But I would say it's also the steepest learning curve. And it's kind of the most intimidating, like, of all the modalities, because it's like, you know, it's echo. It's kind of like the purview of cardiology. You're doing an echo on a patient, but you're only looking for specific things. You're looking for big things.
And it's just yes or no, right? I mean, you're not doing advanced calculations.
Exactly. It's binary questions you're trying to ask.
Right.
And so, like, you know, ASEP recommends 25 to 50 scans per study area for their credentialing process. That's kind of what the current guidelines are. But really, for echo, you should probably have a couple hundred echoes under your belt before you practice emergency medicine. That's kind of how I approach it with my residents.
I mean, it sounds intimidating, but I mean, that's probably how many EKGs you need to do before you would be good at EKGs.
At
least. Many x-rays that you should read before you probably are good at x-rays. So, I mean, sounds like a lot, but that's everything. You need to get that many to be well at it.
The table bump.
I did not actually. That just went with it. Sorry.
The conductive sound from a microphone picking up those little.
I just get passionate about my echo, I guess.
And that's what happens. People get passionate about their microphone sitting on their desk.
Yeah.
The thing is with the echo is most of us know a little bit of it already. If you're trained and do fasts, you're already used to getting that image of the heart.
True.
It's just, you know, I'm already looking for pericardial effusion. I'm very comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty comfortable with right heart strain because it's easy. It's just, does that look bigger than that? Mm-hmm. You know, the one with the thin muscle, is it bigger than the one with the big muscle?
Right.
And I think there's some other stuff, but that rolls into the one that I feel like is potentially, and maybe it's not the most difficult. Maybe it's just because haven't had enough experience with it yet. But the use of the ultrasound for the lungs. I mean, you talked about the undifferentiated hypotensive patient, looking at sepsis versus PE versus decompensated heart failure, where you're just hideously fluid volume overloaded. And with the new sepsis criteria, not necessarily new, but if you stick with a lot of the sepsis recommendations that are out there, that hypotensive patient that's tachypneic, you're going to hit them with 30 cc's per kilogram of fluid, but then their boat may already be floating. So you may not need any more water in the ocean. So tell me about the use of the ultrasound, one, to differentiate that undifferentiated hypotensive patient, but also the use on the lungs. Because you talked about earlier when we were talking about chest x-rays, and I'm saying they're not getting read at night, and you're saying, well, it's not really a great test anyway.
Yeah.
Talk about that in terms of the thorax. Let's hit the thorax with the ultrasound.
Do you mind if I... Do you want to talk about it?
I think you got it.
So, the lungs are, like, actually my favorite. Like, if I understand that the echo is probably the most useful as far as critically ill patients. His echo is kind of like Ben's, like, baby. But lungs is my baby. Like, I love the lungs. I've read a lot of stuff, and I'm convinced that it's the best thing to do. With anything chest, the x-ray is more sensitive. It is as specific as the x-ray is for, like, things like pneumonia, for pneumothorax. They're as specific, but as far as sensitivity goes, the x-ray is really horridly insensitive for everything in the chest. It can't rule out heart failure. It cannot rule out a pneumothorax. It cannot rule out a PE, and it cannot rule out pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
Continue.
You said the ultrasound is most sensitive. You want to...
Oh, no, you said the x-ray is more sensitive.
That's what
you meant the ultrasound is more sensitive.
That's what you meant.
It's
literally the opposite of what I mean.
I know, yeah, I just...
The back end made sense. It was just the lead end has everybody now ordering x-rays.
Okay, so the x-ray, everything that the x-ray can evaluate, the ultrasound is more sensitive for.
Ah, yes. There.
Yes. So the x-ray and the ultrasound have very similar specificities, right? So if they show an abnormality... If the x-ray shows a big consolidation, if the ultrasound shows a big consolidation, they'll have similar specificities. But as far as sensitivities go, which is what we need in the emergency department, ultrasound is better. Ben, what's the do you remember what sensitivity for, like, pneumothorax?
Pneumothorax is 50% subpinex ray.
What about, like, a pneumonia?
Pneumonia? I don't know the exact number.
It's 50%. It's a coin flip.
Yeah,
so all this stuff, I mean, we look at, you know, we have a patient that comes in and we think that they have pneumonia and we get the x-ray and we're like, oh, there's no pneumonia on there. There's been plenty of situations where I'm convinced just clinically that the patient has pneumonia. X-ray is completely clear. and you go with the ultrasound, you see a huge consolidation, you know, behind the heart on the left or something like that. You know, one of the things that bothered me so much is, you know, oh, I think the patient has pneumonia, or I think they have heart failure. Let's give them some fluids and see if it like fluffs out. That just seems so ridiculous when you have a test that is sensitive enough to pick it out before you have to, you know, have them. What's the word?
Decompensate?
No. Like when they present, declare. Before they like declare themselves, you need to get on top of it before that. And it's actually fairly easy, like B-lines for pulmonary edema. The learning curve for that is exquisitely not steep. Mm-hmm. You take beginners, people that don't even know how to use ultrasound, it's very easy for them to identify B-lines versus A-lines. A pneumonia, the only downside, the only thing that's tricky about pneumonia is you just got to remember to scan the back. You just have to sit them up and scan the back of their lungs because that's where pneumonias are. That's the only tricky thing, I think, that people forget to do. They'll just scan anteriorly, scan laterally, and forget that most pneumonias are posterior.
So how long of a study are we talking about, though? How long is it going to take you to screen for pneumonia?
2 minutes. It would take probably most people like 3 or 4 minutes. You just sit them up, and you just move the transducer in a lawnmower up their rib spaces. I mean, it really doesn't take that long. It seems intimidating, but it really doesn't take that long. The way that I do it is I have the probe sagittal, so pointing upwards along the rib spaces, and I'll evaluate with the curvilinear probe. I'll evaluate like 2 or so rib spaces at a time. I'll just move back and forth sagittal, and then if I identify, looking always at that white pleural line, you know, that white line underneath the ribs. If I see any dips in that white pleural line, anything weird, like a weird B line, a little black underneath that pleural line, I'll stop at that area, turn it transverse, so in between the ribs, and then scan in that little space to double check and see if I find it there. And if I don't see anything there, I go back sagittal and I do my screening exam and continue on. Do both backs, both sides, and both fronts. It really doesn't take that long.
And then the difference between, so the big things we're going to be looking for, mm-hmm. And that probably get us tore up from the floor up front when it comes to chest x-ray, looking at the lungs, is that differentiation, atelectasis versus heart failure versus pneumonia, mm-hmm. versus just other chronic parenchymal lung disease. What are we looking for?
So that is something that a lot of people bring up because I think people want, and I wish we had it, you know, like this always means this and this always means this, but that doesn't exist. What I do is I always talk to the patient, get the history, and I'll do a little physical exam first, and then I will have my differential based off of what I do after I talk to the patient, after I do my physical exam. So if they come with a fever and a cough, pneumonia is number one on my differential. So I'm going to look for pneumonia first, right? If somebody has, you know, is tall, he's Marfanoid, playing basketball, and suddenly got short of breath and has chest pain on the right, I'm going to look for a pneumothorax first, right? So if an old person comes in undifferentiated shortness of breath and they have B lines bilaterally, but just in the dependent portions, they've been laying down flat on their back, it could be heart failure, but it's probably atelectasis. It's probably that increased density in the lung from them laying down so much, right? Somebody's on the ventilator, they have bilateral small static bronchograms. So they have like fairly good sized consolidations bilaterally. They're on the vent. They don't have a fever. Pneumonia is not. Bilateral pneumonia is probably unlikely. I'm going to say that patient probably has bilateral atelectasis, right? Mm-hmm. A young patient comes in, he fever, cough, he's got patchy B lines bilaterally. It's probably not a heart failure. It's probably he's got some atypical pneumonia or viral pneumonia. So there's very few findings that always mean an abnormality, right? A lung point usually always means a pneumothorax, so that's one of them. Dynamic air bronchograms usually mean pneumonia. But really all the other findings could be a bunch of stuff depending on what the patient looks like in front of you and what the most likely thing.
So taking the information from the picture, which I mean is what we do with theoretically do with everybody, is figuring out where you fall on the spectrum of illness and disease and what's mm-hmm. most likely going to be the issue. And I mean, for my patients, the most important thing is that we can figure out a good way to diagnose that double walking pneumonia that everybody seems to get that only gets better with the Z-Pak every time they get a cough and cold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and one thing that's important, Ben taught me this, is that you should never use the ultrasound in isolation. You always got to look at the patient in front of you. I think that's important for everybody to remember, especially when they're starting out.
Well, it's the tool. I mean, it's a tool that's better. I mean, we're finding more and more that our stethoscopes are lying to us. They're great reflex hammers, but they're lying to us from the audible standpoint that our chest x-rays just aren't sensitive enough. It's basically just like a Maybe it's like it's kind of the medical equivalent of a point of care Kim aid or something like that. It's a good screening, but it really doesn't dig in there and get the details that mm-hmm. you want. And in terms of, you know, decreasing exposure to radiation with CT scans, MRIs, things like that, because that's really one of the things that cranks up after hours is those CT scans to get the better differentiation of what's going on with these patients and what's really there and what's not, when you can't clearly see a consolidation or source for the patient's complaints.
Right.
And so it's a great way that's low cost, not very invasive, or not invasive at all, really, mm-hmm. unless you do a procedure. And then you throw on top of that how superior it is to the other techniques without being exposed to ionizing radiation.
Yeah.
It's something everybody needs to do. Well, give us an idea. So say people are listening out there. We've got emergency physicians out there listening. And how do they get good and started on ultrasound? Say you want to start a program at your hospital. I mean, I was blessed and fortunate enough to, right as I got into practice, had Matt come in and start working with our group. So it was like cheating. But say you're out there and you don't have one of the Kentucky or Tennessee sono nerds up there to take care of them. So how do we do it?
Well, I think the first thing that you should do is to get your group together and actually everybody take a course together. A course, like you need an ultrasound machine at your shop.
That's a good start.
That's a good start. So you need to make a purchasing decision. And once you get some guidance on that, and there's plenty of documents out there about what's good and what's not, you need to, I'd say taking a course would be step one. And that is just barely step one, though. I would say that a lot of people who take, ultrasound courses, they feel like they're going to go to a three-day course, then they're going to come out a superstar in ultrasound. Well, that's just not the case. It's just like anything else. You got to practice to be good. And so once you take your three-day course, then you need to have some sort of continuing mentorship. So at a given place, you need to have one person that is identified as the champion of ultrasound at your shop, the ultrasound director, as it were, that helps do QA education. And that you need to have that nidus of education at your shop to continue to teach your doctors how to use ultrasound over the years to come, because it's not going to happen overnight, and you really need to continue practicing to keep your skills up, just like any other procedure.
I mean, I see baby steps. You start off with the low hanging fruit, whether it being DVT, VAST, your basic lung ultrasounds. I have access type stuff, the low hanging fruit. And then as you work forward, maybe stepping up as a group and saying this, then this, and this, then this, as you advance. I mean, I think it's really important to have somebody who is certified, so resident trained within the last decade or so, that at least is familiar, knows their way around the ultrasound. I think it'd be hard if you're purely a group of non-EM folks or people that graduated earlier than that to really pick it up and get it going. Because what you'll find is the hospital isn't really excited to buy it for you because they don't see the reimbursement, but you really can't get going unless you have a machine to do it on. And so it's kind of the
it's the
cart before the horse kind of stuff. But you have to have something. But that's what's nice now is they are getting reasonable. It's not like a huge capital investment for the ultrasound anymore. Nice machines are under $50,000. Yeah. I mean, there's some you can buy. Of course, you can buy more, but nice machines, $40,000 to $50,000, and now even these portable, even ultra portable devices that are used for screening. Give us an idea on you guys when we're how people can get more information. Say they want to come to your courses where you guys teach and where they can get more information from you.
So Ben has a website called Ultrasound of the Week. It sends out emails with just cases, very short. It's all, you just read it on your computer, very quick. I have one called 5MinuteSono.com, and I have basically a tutorial website. So the reason I built it is to have, basically, if you wanted to remember how to look for a cardiac function before you go into the patient, you watch this quick video. It shows you like what probe to use, how to put your hand on the probe on the patient. Then of course the ultrasound podcast. We have some courses. Ben and I do quite a few of them. The big ones that we do is with the ultrasound podcast people. We do One Lexington, Castle Fest. We do Yellowstone, which is actually in Jackson Hole, and then Cava is the other one that we do. But there's other things you can do. There's this thing called the Ultrasound Leadership Academy, which is basically an online fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
There's Ultrasound Course in the Box, which is basically they can send you all the materials, or they can send you all the materials and have someone come out and teach it. There's a lot of ways that it can be done, basically. And a lot of there's a Third Rock, I think, in one of the Carolinas, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
There's a Sonoran, which is Chris Fox's company out in California. There's a lot of different ways that you can kind of start picking this up.
It's key. I mean, to have somebody as advanced as you guys, you know, coming up and picking your brain about how to do these is invaluable, because you can get the shortcuts and the tips right off the bat, so you're not learning those bad habits and things.
Right.
All right, social media access, emails, whatnot. How do folks get in touch with you?
So we're both on Twitter. I am at UltrasoundMD at 5 Minute Sono. I also run the ASAP Twitter account, and on Ultrasound Podcast as well.
And I am at Ultrasound Jelly. And Ultrasound of the Week, you can find me there.
That's fantastic. We got to let Jacob get to bed. He's been working the last few nights, and we were the last thing between him and some solid REM cycles.
Yeah, I think I might be dead. I'm not sure. I feel weird.
You're gonna wake up dead.
I'm gonna wake up dead.
You wake up dead.
I might swallow my tongue.
You know, they've done research. They've done all kinds of research on this, on what your equivalent BAC is with this little sleep. So.
Yeah. Maybe I should Uber.
Yeah, Uber home. Why? Because I'm sleepy.
Oh, one last point. I don't know if you want to put this around the ultrasound pod, or the you know, education portion, but the Ultrasound Leadership Academy is unique in that it's a longitudinal curriculum over, depends how long you want to do it. You could do it over a year, 6 months, over 2 years. We both actually work for the Ultrasound Leadership Academy. That is actually a disclosure. But the nice thing is that you have the online materials, you get to go to the courses, all these courses that Jacob just mentioned for free, and then you get like however many hours you've subscribed to a month FaceTime to do like Google Hangouts and look over scans and get tips from people like myself and Jacob. Mike and Matt,
also
basically
like actual smart people like Mike and Matt.
Exactly. International ultrasound educators who are a lot smarter than us, and you have access to these people, and you can both network with them and be you know, this actually is a good venue to become an ultrasound educator if you want to become the director of ultrasound or be that champion of ultrasound in your group.
All right, great start, guys. Great start. And I know there's a couple spots available at the Castle Fest. So if you're interested in getting down there and come see beautiful Lexington during the during horse racing season, right before the Kentucky Derby, so it's a great time to be there. Lots of cool and awesome things going on, and great time to learn a whole bunch of new stuff in a really cool environment. And you don't even have to mandatorily wake up early and do that crazy Matt running around calisthenics, competitive yoga, all that other stuff. So as for me, you can contact me. Hope you like our ASAP Frontline page. I can't even remember face page. You got me tired now.
Face page.
Yeah, face page. Get on the face page and
get on the My Book.
face page and Twitterage. And get the ASAP Frontline, and then on Twitter at EverydayMed. Also, feel free to contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.